This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This week in the news, the first aircraft in history to make a powered, controlled flight on another planet. Green aviation from IAG Southwest Airlines and Universal Hydrogen. The F-15EX gets a new name. A museum reopens and a major GA event gets canceled. Sun and Fun Aerospace Expo recap, and even a Lego story. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 651 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
All right. I've been here all these weeks. Where have you been?
I've been away for 3 weeks, and it's tough to come home. And
I keep showing up every Monday, and it's like, there's nobody here.
No one here. Yeah, we've been doing some different things in the interim, but we are back, and joining us is David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks historian.
I haven't been here. I've been sleeping. I've been getting used to this, having Monday nights off. Not sure what we're doing, you know. Almost forgot tonight, like other people in the building.
That's right. That's right. Some others did. But not Rob Mark. He didn't forget. That's because he's senior editor of Flying Magazine, and he publishes the Jetwine blog.
Of course I didn't forget. Forget what?
Yeah.
Hey, guys. Evening. Thank you for inviting me. It's nice because I didn't go to Florida.
No, but I did. And we'll talk about that coming up. No guest tonight because I've been gone for 3 weeks, so we haven't gotten anything scheduled guest-wise, but we'll fill that in the coming weeks. So we've got some news from the past week or so, some aviation news specifically. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West. Mm.
Ready from Biden's home state.
Rob, I like this this headline in Flying Magazine. Ingenuity becomes the first aircraft to fly on another planet. That means the aircraft from Earth to fly on another planet, correct?
Okay, picky. Other people liked the title. I'm sorry if you were unhappy. I didn't get your memo. So, no, I really thought it was nice that they, when the Ingenuity copter flew, what did it go? I think it went up 2-3 feet, so a meter
three,
the first time.
3 meters the first flight.
Oh, 3 meters the first flight. Okay. But it didn't last very long.
No, just 30 seconds. It hovered still, for 30 seconds, and the total flight was 39 seconds.
Well, great. So what do you need me for? So, no, but I really thought this was pretty cool that they attached a piece of the original Wright Brothers flyer to the machine. And so when it took off, it was also a first. And I wonder how many people really thought about it that way. I mean, if this had been 1969 again, when they first landed on the moon and people went insane, it's one thing, but I bet a lot of people didn't even know what was going on. And that's always a shame because they put so much work into making this thing go. But each flight has gotten a little longer. I think, isn't one of them supposed to go to Jupiter and back and then pick up the guys at Mars? Or
no, that's a separate.
Maybe I got that wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But hey, did you actually, seriously though, you know, we were talking about space flight and Ingenuity, the helicopter, received an official international call sign, as did the Martian base where the crater that they were operating from. And let's take a look at those. Max, can you pronounce those cool, that cool name of that crater?
Well, the the area, well, the crater is Jezero Crater, and the area there from which the Ingenuity helicopter has been flying has been termed Wright Brothers Field. So ICAO now has established official designations for both Ingenuity and Wright Brothers Field. Wright Brothers Field is JZRO for Jezero's crater. And the first flight of the Ingenuity was given the three-letter designator IGY and the call sign Ingenuity.
Yeah, but see, now I'm confused because there's a Wright Brothers Field just outside of Dayton, I believe. And David, if we see the, you know, the Wright Brothers Field designation here, how will we know if we're referring to Mars or to the one in Dayton?
How do you tell the difference between O'Hare and Midway?
Well, they have different identifiers. They don't call them both the same airport.
Well, why do you think they gave the Mars Jezero crater and not Wright Field?
I thought they did call it Wright Brothers Field.
They call it Wright Brothers Field, but the designator is Jezero Crater.
Oh, I see. So that was just a name made up to confuse people like me.
Yes.
I've got you.
Absolutely.
And, and it worked.
All right. All right. I'm with you now. Okay.
Well, I'm confused too because I just pulled out my ForeFlight application and I entered the identifier in there. And it says it's going to take me 7 years and 6 months to get to Mars. And I don't know.
Now, is that in the Cirrus?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So Ingenuity has had three flights so far as we record this. We mentioned the first flight. The second flight flew a little bit higher, up to 5 meters, and it maintained its position, tilted at an angle, moved laterally about 2 meters, and it was a little bit longer flight, almost 52 seconds. And then the third flight, same altitude, 5 meters, but it flew downrange about 50 meters and then returned. It reached a top speed of, let's see, it says 6.6 feet per second, or 2 meters per second, which, according to my little calculator, is about 4.5 miles an hour. But the Ingenuity does not carry any science instruments. This is purely a flight demonstration or proving that aircraft can fly in an environment like the Martian environment. Now, I think AeroVironment was the contractor, the NASA contractor that built Ingenuity. And they made an interesting note, I think maybe in advance of the first flight, talking about the risks of that flight, because they said they were, quote, unable to test the vehicle in the environment in which it would fly. The Ingenuity was tested at the JPL Labs, the JPL's space simulator, which is a large vacuum chamber filled with CO2 gas to simulate it, but it doesn't completely simulate it. And of course, the lower gravity and the temperatures, and also, so I think they were all holding their breath a bit for the first flight. And again, they're just looking to see can we do controlled flight on another planet? And then in the future, I think we'd see the kinds of applications that they're really looking for, scouting and discovery and things like that in the future on Mars, as well as, let's see, where's it, David, they're going? Titan, I think, is a future mission planned. Right.
But one of the important aspects I don't think people are realizing is Ingenuity flies autonomously.
Right. It's a drone.
Although NASA doesn't call it that, it calls it a helicopter.
Yeah.
But Ginny does fly by herself, you know, and what was interesting about the first flight was it had taken place, and it, because of the time delay between from the flight to when it reaches Earth via the satellite system, you know, it was already takeoff, flew, and land before we even knew it happened. you know, there's this time delay that so Ginny does this whole thing by herself and then reports back that it's complete. So, I mean, it really is a marvelous piece of artificial intelligence that gets kind of missed, that people think that, you know, JPL is running it, but basically they send it the information and it figures out how to do it itself and then reports back that it's done.
Hey, I know you guys aren't old enough to remember this movie from the late 70s, but do you guys remember hearing about Capricorn 1? That was that thriller film in which they supposedly had a Mars landing, but instead it was all faked because...
You mean the one with O.J. Simpson?
There you go. That's it. You know, I have not heard anybody come out and say that, you know, this was faked, but I'm going to be the first. They faked this landing.
No.
No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding.
I know it's a big deal at the museum for us because, and we're going to issue an award because it is a helicopter, you know, and with very, very, very fast rotor blades, which substantially faster than any helicopter rotor blades here on Earth, because the atmosphere is so, there's such a lack of density. So, I mean, it is a marvelous piece of technology, you know, the fact that it flew underneath Perseverance, you know, and then dropped off and it's charging its own batteries and keeping itself warm at night and all of the things involved with a normal flight, you know. So I think the Wright brothers would be amazed that now they have a piece of their aircraft on the moon and a piece of their aircraft on Mars.
There's a piece on the moon as well?
There was a piece of the Wright flyer that flew on Apollo 11 and was and left as an artifact with the Apollo 11 mission. In 1969.
Oh. Yeah, but how much of the Wright flyer can they pull apart as we explore the heavens over the next few decades? I mean,
90% of the fabric from the original flyer has been redone at the Smithsonian, and the fabric is stored away for future things. So, yeah, there isn't a lot of fabric with ingenuity, because ingenuity was optimal for lightweight, but you know, it's important, you know. I mean, there was a meme out a couple of weeks ago that was pretty much awesome, which was a picture of a F4F Wildcat, an F-14 Tomcat, and then an F-35B. And the notation was, there was 40 years between the Wildcat and the Tomcat, and now 40 years between the Tomcat and the F-35. So we are as far away from we're 80 years away from World War II, you know, and 40 years away from basically the highlight of the Tomcat. So, I mean, it's amazing how far we've come in, you know, and it's exciting to see spaceflight again. I woke up that morning, even though I knew that it was just going to be a bunch of people showing a bunch of data. But when that video came on showing it flew, or that shadow from the camera showing it, it was amazing.
It really is something special. And I agree, David, that and I've heard you say this many times before, is that spaceflight is exciting again. And that's great. That's
right. So who gets to put this time in their logbook? Is there some guy at JPL who got to log it?
No.
Probably not.
Yeah. Darn. Yeah.
There was no instructor to officially to look over, because as he said, it only reported back when it was done. I mean, anybody could say, oh, we did it.
Yeah. Well, and that's also why the slow, lengthy testing of the motors and the blades and the recharging and all that in advance of the first flight. I mean, we didn't land and then immediately launch this helicopter. We had to make sure that, or it had to make sure that its systems were working properly with this delay, so that you can't test in real time.
Well, and just I want to just spoiler alert. When Ingenuity shows up in the National Air and Space Museum, folks, it's not going to be the same one.
Right. Yeah. It's not coming back, in other words.
It's not coming back. Right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to another topic. This is in Travel Daily News. IAG to power 10% of its flights with sustainable aviation fuel by 2030. IAG, of course, is International Airlines Group, and that encompasses British Airways, Iberia, let's see, Aer Lingus, Iberia Express, and then Level and Vueling. And they intend to purchase 1 million tons of sustainable jet fuel every year. And they say that would lower annual emissions by 2 million tons by 2030, which is the equivalent of taking a million cars off the road each year. We're seeing more activity lately, it seems, in regards to carbon emissions from commercial aviation. We had a lot of, kind of a flurry of sustainable fuel activity a couple of years ago, and then seemed like not a lot. But we're starting to see a few more things happening in that space. And above and beyond the use of sustainable jet fuel by IAG, they're also working with their suppliers. They're looking to ensure that their suppliers are net zero by 2050 for the products and services that they provide to IAG. I think that's significant, by reaching, you know, back through the supply chain and working with suppliers to achieve the same sorts of objectives.
Most of the airlines here in the U.S. have announced various agreements to use sustainable fuel. San Francisco International, interestingly, has a local agreement with a refinery which pumps it directly out to the airport. And already Signature, which fuels the jets that come in via GA, has already pumped a million gallons of sustainable fuel. So it's moving ahead rapidly.
There are a couple of companies that are producing that fuel. Lanza Jet is one. Velocis, I guess is how you pronounce that, is another. Lanza Jet is interesting. They received investment seed money from Suncor Energy, which is a Canadian company, and the Japanese trading company Mitsui and Company for $15 million and $10 million respectively. And LanzaJet hopes to start production in early 2022. At least that's what they said in 2020. So I don't know if that's still their, you know, their current plan, but that's what they announced in 2020.
Of course, the one thing I didn't see in this whole thing was a relative price on the sustainable fuel. Did you?
No, it's there isn't any information here about that. But the IAG chief executive, Louis Gallego, he said that the government must participate in this. In fact, he said, quote, government support is critical to meet this target by attracting investment to construct sustainable aviation fuel plants that will deliver enough supply for the airline industry. So what I take from that is that without government support, which I guess means subsidy or something, without that, that maybe the economics of this fuel doesn't create the financial justification for it. In other words, that, you know, you need some support, that it doesn't pay for itself at this point. At least that's what I take from those comments.
David, what are you staring at? David, I like your ears. I mean, oh gosh, that's not David. Wow,
that's a dog.
I'm sorry.
We've had cats on the show.
What's his name again, David?
Bean.
Yes.
And who's got the fire trucks going by their house?
I kept muting the mic, and every darn time I turn around, there's another one. I don't know. Maybe the neighborhood's burning down.
Yeah, as long as they're not coming to your house, Rob.
Good point.
Another item from Dallas Innovates. This is Southwest Airlines continues to support its sustainable aviation fuel research to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the U.S. Department of Energy has something called the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the NREL. And they are planning to use a biorefining process to create sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, they like to call it, that's created from wet waste, like food. And Southwest Airlines is supporting NREL in this. Southwest wants to be carbon neutral by 2050, and they see sustainable aviation fuel as having an important role in that, which I think it probably does. The NREL scientist says that they've demonstrated how to make sustainable aviation fuel from wet waste that is compatible with existing jet engines, says it has the potential for a carbon negative footprint when diverting food waste from landfills. You know, I thought about this today when I was at the grocery store picking up some produce, and there was a guy, an employee, pushing a cart, and he was kind of poking around in the potatoes and picking out the soft ones and the tomatoes that were overripe and the banana, and he had a whole cart full of fuel. And I was thinking of this. I mean, this is what NREL is talking about turning into jet fuel, I guess.
Well, I think that was predicted a long time ago, right? Didn't the Back to the Future movies have kind of garbage and stuff going into the DeLorean to fuel it?
Yeah.
At least in one version of the movie.
Yeah. There was a DeLorean at Sun Fund. We can talk about that coming up, too.
That's if anybody even knew what it was, right?
Well, I bet it didn't get off the ground.
It was driving. No, it was definitely an elderly crowd at Sun and Fun this year. They knew what that was.
Well, that's the trouble with every air show, is it's a rather elderly crowd.
Yeah, yes, yes. Well, especially a fly-in type of air show like this. The demographics of aircraft owners kind of drive the participants that you see there. But still on, low-carbon footprint, green aviation, there's something called H2 View, which is a publication, a website, I guess, that was established in July 2019. And they want to serve what they call the hydrogen economy globally. And they have a piece in there, Universal Hydrogen raises $2.5 million to accelerate hydrogen aviation. And so this company, Universal Hydrogen, has this new funding. They're targeting 2025 for the first commercial regional aircraft flights. These guys are on top of things because they were able to score a great website. They have hydrogen.aero. Which is appropriate. The investor list is kind of interesting. I mean, there's some investors that you've never heard of. Fortescue Future Industries, Global Founders Capital, Plug Power, stuff like that. But there's also Airbus Ventures in there. That's interesting. Also, JetBlue Technology Ventures is an investor in there.
Toyota AI Ventures.
Yeah, that's kind of it, Toyota AI Ventures. So Universal Hydrogen, it's a California company. They're planning on building and testing full-scale hardware for these hydrogen commercial aircraft.
Well, it's amazing to me as they're talking about retrofitting existing 40 to 60 passenger regional planes. Those are pretty big planes. You know, often when we hear about alternate power sources, we're looking at, for example, the new 8-passenger turboprop out of by aerospace. Well, that's powered by batteries and it's only 8 passengers. But you get up to 40 to 60, we're talking some pretty big airframes.
Yes. Now we've talked maybe a little bit on this show, but also Dave and I have talked about hydrogen power for drones on UAV Digest, and one of the topics of conversation is in what form do you place the hydrogen in the aircraft? Is it compressed gas or is it liquid? Compressed gas has a much simpler containment requirement. Liquid hydrogen, of course, I mean, you need a pretty robust vessel to
super cooling, man. You got to get that thing.
And all that. But, of course, you get a lot more energy density per volume with liquid. So universal hydrogen is, it says they're looking at exploring both of those alternatives. But another thing is that, you know, we talk about the distribution network for biofuels or the distribution network for hydrogen. And what universal hydrogen is looking at is what they are referring to as modular capsules. So the hydrogen, I guess, whether it's compressed or liquid, would be produced in these capsules. The capsules would be transported via the existing freight network to airports or to wherever the airplanes were, which I guess would be the airports. And then the aircraft would accept these capsules. So the advantage of that is that you don't need hydrogen pipelines, you don't need hydrogen storage facilities, and that whole infrastructure, fuel trucks, the infrastructure that we have now for aviation fuel, carbon-based fuel, with this capsule kind of approach, which is, I think that's kind of interesting.
That's fascinating. So you're saying you would swap these things out, just as some people proposed swapping batteries on airplanes?
It kind of sounds that way. Now, they explicitly talk about it being in these capsules for the transportation portion of it. It doesn't really say. I mean, it kind of suggests that, yes, like you said, that the capsules would be the containment vessel in the aircraft, but maybe there would be an unloading process. I don't know. If they were going to retrofit aircraft, I mean, having a modular approach might make more sense. But it's interesting nonetheless.
Well, I was thinking, obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious, but I'm not sure it would be cost effective to run pipelines of hydrogen all over the country.
Right.
But I was thinking back to what the company Air Products did when they innovated. Boy, this is probably 40 plus years ago. It used to be that companies needed various gases, would have cylinders, trucked all over to get their gases. And then Air Products came along and said, we can just build gas generators, whatever the gas happens to be, on the site and have companies produce it there. I wonder if there's a model where somebody could develop a hydrogen generator, sell these to the airports, and they would just generate their own hydrogen right there at the airport.
Mm, interesting. Yeah. We should probably learn more about how you produce hydrogen, because I don't really know, other than I've read that it takes a lot of electricity by most current methods of creating hydrogen. But I don't know
which is the argument that a lot of people are making, is how is electricity generated to make the we're still using lots of fossil fuels to make the electricity to make the gas to prevent from using fossil fuels. It's sort of we need to go to a nuclear option.
Yeah, no,
but I'm bummed.
Yeah, actually, yeah, yes, actually, although there's people have strong feelings about that, but the technology, the nuclear power generating technology, has changed quite a bit from the incidents that have happened in the past. But another, it's kind of related to this. Another thing that I keep seeing popping up in the news lately is leaded general aviation fuel, and I've seen some articles that, I mean, they're basically asking, "Gee, we got rid of leaded fuel for automobile use many years ago. How come these piston-powered general aviation planes still use leaded fuel? And how safe is that?" I don't know if you guys have seen some of those issues. Is there anything on the horizon, or do piston GA airplane or engines, are they going to live forever on leaded fuel?
Well, I know. Oh, go ahead, Rob.
You're on mute.
Rob is on mute.
And of course, that pretty much is the answer. There are a couple of companies that have been looking at low lead replacements. But of course, the problem is they can't seem to solve high compression, you know, issue along with detonation that it creates when it's not correct. And I mean, I'm not a chemist, so I'm not going to explain this really well. But again, and so they've been talking about it, and they've been fussing with it and testing it. And I mean, I wrote a story 2 or 3 years ago about this, and the main issue is that it's not just 100 low lead here in the States, but you can't even get 100 low lead in a lot of places in the country. So some of these engine manufacturers were trying to promote going all diesel because you could put Jet A in those things. I imagine other things too, but you don't have to worry about it. But I remember listening to somebody at, no, it wasn't Pratt, it was somebody else. No, it was, I'm sorry, not Pratt, I mean Lycoming, I think. But and the work they have to go through for some of these users in remote, not even necessarily remote parts of the country, but say in Africa, in the Middle East, somebody has to get out there and pre-package what's the phrase I'm looking for to, you know, stash 55 gallon drums in places so that when a GA airplane shows up, they have 100 low lead for it. But that's very expensive to do, kind of like what we're talking about with sustainable fuel. And then, of course, the big issue is that the EPA has not come down on them. They kept thinking, oh, it's going to happen soon. The EPA is going to say, okay, as of 2027, no more lead of any kind, so get used to it and you better figure it out. But it never really happens. So I think people get a little comfortable saying, well, you know, we can do some more work on this. It may take another 6 months or a year, and we'll kind of keep at it. And but there's right now no particular pressure on them to solve the problem.
They've been working on this for more than 20 years, and I think a lot of us thought that they would come up with a solution much sooner. And there are some fuels available today. The big problem, you know, Rob mentioned the low compression. The big problem is that it's really only the lower horsepower engines that can use it. And so if you were to, you know, suddenly mandate, okay, everyone has to use that fuel, all of the more powerful engines, and not that much more. I can't remember where the threshold is, but it's probably somewhere between 100 and 150 horsepower, which means, you know, that's really only the low end of the fleet that's going to be able to do it. Let's just take the mid-range. You know, every Cirrus, every Mooney, every Beechcraft, these aircraft aren't going to be able to run on these fuels, at least as they're currently formulated anyway.
Right, and that's what everybody's worried about, is that we better get moving, because when the EPA, if there's a particular administration in the White House that really gets focused on emissions, sustainability, I don't think we'll see any of those soon, but we might. And who knows? It may just come down like a hammer and say, guys, you know, 5 years, that's it, and good luck. And if you don't do it, then I guess your airplanes aren't going to go anywhere. And then there's really going to be a war between the OEMs and the engine manufacturers. And it ain't going to be pretty.
Is there any danger? I was going to say, is there any danger of like EASA coming down on it? Or, I mean, I'm surprised that there isn't a global initiative to get rid of the low lead.
Well, see, I don't think there's that much except here in North America and some in the UK. But again, we are primarily the largest user of 100 low lead because we have the largest GA fleet of airplanes like, what's that guy in the middle there with the glasses? That's Max, right? I was going to say the guy in the middle. And for people that don't know what we're looking at, I'm looking at two people in the middle with glasses.
I'm looking at you with glasses also.
that'll ground Bonanzas, Moonies, Piper, high compression Pipers. The whole industry will just come to a grinding halt. And nobody wants that, of course, but nobody seems to be jumping on board to try to solve the problem. But of course, I forgot how many years ago it was that I was in a car dealer, you know, and I said, do I need my oil changed? And he went, "Yeah, not really." And I said, "But I've got like 12 or 13,000 miles on these." "It's okay." And I went, "Oh, duh, because there's no lead in the fuel any longer, and that's really a problem on a little airplane like a 150, a 172. You are removing those plugs every 40 or 50 hours to clean them to get rid of the lead. So it's a maintenance hog, but pilots have just gotten used to it."
Yeah. Continuing to kick the can down the road because it's a difficult problem to solve, it could just lead to more pain later. I mean, all it takes, well, not about all it takes, but I could imagine some lawsuit by some family who lived next to an airport and their, you know, kids are, their health is damaged by lead, and, you know, there's an association made, and, you know, I mean, it could get pretty messy. So
I'm actually surprised it hasn't yet to date.
Yeah. Well, we may see that, unfortunately. All right. Military item moving along. The F-15EX has a new name. David, what's the new name?
The Eagle 2.
The Eagle 2. Did it have an old name, or was it just the F-15EX?
Well, the F-15 is named the Eagle. Yeah. It's been named the Eagle since 1972. The E originally was the Strike Eagle, so the F-15E has a different name. Now, this is the EX now has the Eagle 2 because it's going back to an air superiority role. Now, the person who put this in the show notes thought that some person or some journalist screwed up and thought it was the Eagle. It was going to be named the Eagle 2, being T-O-O. Well, there is a history of McDonnell Douglas aircraft being named, even though it's the same aircraft, being named 2, starting with the A-4. The A-4M, which was revised for the Marines, had a bigger engine and also flew with the Blue Angels, was called the Skyhawk 2. When the upgraded Harrier came through with the upgraded engines, etc., it became the Harrier 2, or then eventually the Harrier 2 Plus. So Eagle 2 is not an unusual name, like we currently have the Lightning 2, but that's because it was named after the P-38 and the British Electric Lightning. But in this case, Eagle 2 is referring to the fact that it's the superiority Eagle and it's a substantially upgraded aircraft. Better engines, better radar, better performance. And it's not like a normal F-15E, which is a Strike Eagle, or Mudhen, which is designed to carry bombs and be a attack aircraft. The F-15E will be EX will be designed for air-to-air superiority.
You mentioned the engines, and I don't know. There's kind of an interesting recent history with the engines for these, right? I mean, initially this was to be a sole source contract to GE Aviation for the F-110 jet engines, but last year in 2020, the Air Force canceled the sole source and asked for competitive bids. And then earlier this year, the beginning of this year, February in 2021, and this is for some 461 engines, the Air Force said that their acquisition plan was for complete propulsion systems. In other words, the engine and the associated components, something that's fully integrated into the F-15EX fighter jets. And then while the initial F-15EXs had the GE engine, Pratt & Whitney proposed their engine for lots 2 through 9. So I guess, do we have another great engine war going on here, David?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, originally, of course, the F-100 engine was what powered was the motor that powered the F-15. As time has gone on, the GE engine has gone into you're into other productions beyond the Saudis and the Singaporeans. So I think maybe what's going to happen is we're going to have a two-motor split for aircraft. The most common of those is the F-16. Carries both Pratt & Whitney and GE motors. And depending upon the block of aircraft, depends upon the motor. So you've got F-15 CJs and F-15 CGs. The difference between the CJ and the CG is whether it has the GE General Electric motor or the Pratt & Whitney motor. So it's not unheard of to have two motors. Now, this was a big deal that they didn't go with two motors on the F-35, which originally was going to be both Pratt & Whitney and General Electric wanted a part of that program, but they were never opted in. So the Air Force is cyclical. Sometimes they go for multiple engines. Sometimes they go for individual engines. The structures are there for both motors, so I don't know what the underlying thing is other than they're trying to get the best product for the cheapest price.
Yeah, that's the argument. There are arguments for sole source, and there are arguments for splitting the contracts and setting up some competition. The folks that promote the idea of multiple sources is that the suppliers have to compete for each lot, and therefore the government benefits from price competition. The other aspect of it is, well, then you've got two development programs going on in parallel, so you've got to pay for two development programs so that the unit price of both is higher than if it was single-sourced is, you know, one argument that's made. And then you've got the issues of maintenance and, you know, do you have the right tooling for the right engine, depending on which aircraft you're servicing, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know what the bottom line is in terms of, is it better to sole source or is it better to competitively bid these things? But yeah, you're right. We do seem to go in cycles where you know, the military tries it and then the military doesn't do it and then they do it again and they don't do it. So.
And in all fairness, it really does not affect the performance of the aircraft. And both of these engines are mature products that are already out in the field, which is one of the reasons why they're bringing the F-15EX aboard, is they're mature products, they're mature engines, the infrastructure is there to support both engines. So, I mean, if they can get a competition going, you know, there's no advantage. There isn't an advantage over one or the other. You know, a lot of it's preference, though. In the F-16, the Pratt & Whitney, the General Electric motor is more favorable than the Pratt & Whitney motor. Sorry about that, Max. But that being said, all of the F-15s in the Air Force inventory currently use the Pratt & Whitney motor, but we've flown General Electric motors on F-15s for years. So either way, the Air Force can't do anything wrong on this as far as getting the right product or the right mix.
Yeah, and often these things come down to political decisions, you know, whose districts are impacted by the jobs and all that kind of thing.
Yep.
I got a question for the engine expert there, Max. David was saying motors. Does it matter whether it's called a motor or an engine? You're kind of shaking your head.
Yeah, there's a difference between a motor and an engine. I mean, the dictionary definition is different, but people will often use them interchangeably. So
what's the dictionary definition? What's the difference?
I'd have to look. they're engines technically, as I recall. And technically a motor is something different, but we'll leave that to the interested listener to look those up.
The one interested listener.
Yeah, the one. I mean, you.
No. Just curious. Yeah. Not interested.
Yeah. No.
One that imports motion specifically, a prime mover. Any of various power units that develop energy or impart motion, such as a small compact engine, an internal combustion engine, especially a gasoline engine. rotating machine that transforms electrical into mechanical engine. That's the definition of a motor.
Yeah, I tend to think of motors as being more electrical and engines more, you know, kind of classic airplane kind of thing.
Well, in the military, you call them motors.
Really? Huh. I didn't know that.
All right. Moving on to the Udvar-Hazy Center. We see that the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, which, of course, is part of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, is going to reopen on May 5th. I didn't know they were closed completely, but apparently I guess they were.
They closed in December. Northern Virginia shut down. I mean, they had originally opened up Udvar-Hazy, but downtown was still closed. And this is subsequently, the Smithsonian is in the process of reopening everything, including downtown as well as the Udvar-Hazy, as well as the other museums that weren't open, and the National Zoo.
And so May 5th is actually an anniversary date, kind of a major one. It's the 60th anniversary of the first U.S. human space flight by Alan Shepard. So they're opening on that day, which is good. They are going to have some restrictions. They're going to have timed entry passes for all visitors, which in the last 3 weeks I've found that quite frequently, museums and places like that do that, where you have to reserve in advance an admission time of the day. And you can show up early, but you can't get in until then. So the Udvar-Hazy Center is going to do that. Groups greater than six people are not allowed. Face coverings for all visitors ages two and older. Not all of the artifacts will be on view, and some things will be closed. No food service, welcome center will be virtually staffed, and other amenities will be closed. So the question that we have and we keep getting from you all is, you know, is the annual Innovations in Flight Day, which is typically Father's Day weekend, Saturday, is that going to be happening? Because typically we're down there. The airplane geeks are down there, and we have a lot of you all attend as well. And so I don't know, David, with them just kind of barely opening, opening, but with all these restrictions on May 5th, that doesn't sound too encouraging for a full up event in June. Is David gone or is David on mute?
David's gone.
David is gone. All right, wow. He's dropped off.
No, I don't think they're going to open for that. I mean, it would be nice. We keep thinking that, well, now that so many people have been vaccinated, it's kind of on the upswing. I don't think it is yet. I hate to, talk about people staying in their houses and that sort of thing, but I just don't think there are enough people that are vaccinated and the procedures are in place. Look at the people at Sun and Fun. Most of the people didn't have masks on. And if you're one of those people that says, so what? Okay, then you're right. It doesn't matter. But for the people that said, well, actually, I do care. Well, it's still a problem. I think we're going to see that at Oshkosh, certainly. But I think long before that, we'd have to have something better in place for Udvar-Hazy than we have right now.
Yeah. I just saw a tweet a couple of minutes ago from Pete Muntean. He's the CNN aviation correspondent. He said that United had said that searches for European flights are up 19% after the EU announced just the other day that vaccinated Americans will be able to travel. I think there is an upswing going on. I mean, related to that, I saw something just a day or so ago that said one or more of the airlines was offering, get this, $200 round-trip flights to Japan from the U.S. Said it was cheaper to fly to Japan than to fly across the country. So I think there's some powerful forces, both, you know, airlines trying to dangle, low fares, people that are just anxious to travel. So, yeah, it's coming back. I mean, the question is how fast is it going to come back? But it is coming
back.
That's
right. Yeah. And what will be the restrictions when things do change?
Yeah. Well, we hear from reporter at large Launchpad Merzari about Aero Friedrichshafen, which, of course, is the big annual GA event in Europe. Here's Launchpad.
While the U.S. is showing record vaccinations, and that's having a positive effect on air shows, Europe, and specifically Germany, have not seen the great vaccine rollout that we have. Earlier this year, that caused Aero Friedrichshafen's organizers to announce that that show would be moved from almost the exact same time as Sun and Fun to the week before Air Venture. Well, last Wednesday, Germany announced a new set of lockdowns to try and slow the spread of the disease, and this has caused Aero Friedrichshafen to announce that they will cancel their show for 2021. This makes 2 years in a row that the biggest GA air show in Europe has been canceled. Oh, everybody go get your shots, because your reporter at large wants to meet you at an air show.
All right. Yeah, 2 years in a row. Boy, that's a big hit for sure. Well, let's slide into what's up with the geeks, because we can talk about Sun and Fun a little bit. As I think everybody probably knows by now, I was down there for the event, down there in Florida, and Launchpad was there as well. And, well, Launchpad, you know, a lot of people recognize Launchpad. It's really kind of funny. One or two people recognize me, I think by voice, but Launchpad's pretty recognizable. But he was also looking for people.
Hey, Airplane Geeks listeners. Launchpad Merzari here down at Sun and Fun, and I just ran into Rob, where are you? I know you're here. You've got to be here.
No, he looked, but Rob, you weren't there.
I know. Where was I anyway?
You were probably in your little office there writing.
Yes, that's right.
Doing some great journalism.
I didn't go.
You didn't go, but a lot of people did. A lot of people did. We were seeing reports that, at least based on ticket sales, the crowd was at record numbers, more people than had ever been to Sun and Fun in the past. Now, that's not – I think the official numbers are not out yet, so that's just sort of hearsay kind of at this point. But the crowd –
I have to ask, Rob, I mean, isn't that the standard press release they put out every year at Sun and Fun?
No.
I will remain neutral on commenting okay. on that particular topic because my attorney has warned me about making comments on other things like that. But no, seriously, what I care about, too, is let's see where we are 2 or 3 weeks from now for all the people that showed up at Sun and Fun that were either unvaccinated or unmasked and see if any of the infection rates go up because of a mass gathering like that. I hope I'm wrong, but then too, that's kind of what happened to them in India. They had a number of huge gatherings, and they told people everything was pretty cool, and it wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I volunteered this year. I was a volunteer at Sun and Fun Radio, and we had a strict.
Did the food get any better?
I didn't eat any of the. I didn't buy any of the food there. I brought my own, actually. So I can't comment on the food for sale. Although there was a truck selling these donuts, these glazed sugar infused donuts that was quite enticing, but I resisted. But anyway, at the radio station there, and if you don't know, there is a radio station on site on that campus there. And we had a strict mask-only policy. You were not allowed onto the deck or inside especially, but onto the deck if you weren't wearing a mask, and I mean wearing it properly. But the crowd in general was largely maskless. Now, you know, there's no data, but my perception of the attendees was that most of them were of the age group that would have been eligible for vaccinations had they desired them. So I don't know if the, you know, percentage of crowd that was vaccinated was higher than just, you know, what you find at the local supermarket, for example. But it kind of looked that way to me. But
any big announcements come out of Sun and Fun this year?
Not as in the past.
Yeah, I saw that Piper introduced the 100 eye trainer, but it's like, well, that's kind of a refreshed version of the PA-28, and I just didn't recall seeing any big announcements.
Well, but the 100 eye is not new. I mean, it was well, in fact, the last time I was at Sun and Fun must have been 2 years ago. Piper had the big announcement that the 100 eye was coming, and they had one in a tent. You could look at it briefly, but it's right down the road. So this was the year, of course, to bring it out. But again, that one wasn't a brand new one.
Well, Launchpad and I did what we had done in 2019, but just the two of us. We did a live Airplane Geeks episode on the deck at Sun and Fun Radio, and that's what we published last week as episode 650. So it was just Launchpad and I, and we had a guest from NORAD, actually, talking about people that, you know, bust TFRs and end up triggering an intercept.
Are there a lot? I didn't hear that episode. Are there a lot of them? Is that what they talked about? Or
yeah, well, there's a fair number of them. I mean, it varies, but, you know, maybe 60 or something in a year, something like that. And it does happen. And we talk about of course, everybody else has already listened to that episode, Rob, but we talked about that, you know, that process. He's making a face. Launchpad,
you know, this really is a whole lot more fun to do when
you can see faces.
That's true. It's true. The thing I found interesting was that guy is a part-time jet driver. I would have thought people doing intercepts are like full-time active military. He was in the reserves, as I recall.
Yeah, in the reserves. Yeah, the reserves do a lot of that. And what aircraft perform the intercept can depend on where you are and what the situation is. So, for example, in Alaska, you might see F-22s. Converging on you, whereas elsewhere it might be F-16s, and it could be the Coast Guard, it could be a Coast Guard helicopter, or some combination, depending on what the situation is. And of course, we also announced the plane tags giveaway winners, and I heard from Launchpad tonight, and he has made contact with each of them in terms of getting their mailing addresses. So the four plane tags are on their way to them, so that was exciting.
But who would want those, Max? If they're so
lots of people
plane, you meant airplanes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Launchpad was also. I mean, he kept. You know, he's a persistent.
Look at David. He's in agony.
Oh, no, his eyes are rolling.
I'm sorry, David. I didn't mean to upset the puppy. I mean,
the puppy's already left, so you're good.
He got tired of it.
Well, okay. Yeah, Launchpad, one thing that Launchpad doesn't do is get tired. When he's got something, you know, in his head, something he's looking for, he doesn't give up.
Hey, listeners, Launchpad here. Let's go into the radio station. I'll bet you Rob's in there at Sun and Fun Radio out on the deck. Rob. Well, I know he's got to be here somewhere. He'd never miss Sun and Fun.
And this was all in episode 650?
No, this is in episode 651.
Oh, I see.
Just like you are. Just like you.
I will have to reconnect with Launchpad to tell him that I could have saved him the trouble. I wasn't there.
It's too bad because you get to meet listeners, of course, which is a very exciting thing.
It is a lot.
Yeah, so for
it really is.
So here's an example.
Hey, your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari here, and I've run into another geek.
Hi, my name's Grover McNair
from
Raleigh, North Carolina,
and he's down here being a Sun and Fun judge.
Yep.
And he's walking around looking at, and no, he's not going to give me any preferential treatment for chocolate that we're giving him for judging. Oh, no.
Oh, really now? Well, it might be negotiated.
Come see us. Have fun at Sun and Fun. Another happy listener.
Yeah, many people don't realize it unless you attend Sun and Fun or Oshkosh or, you know, some of these events. But Launchpad is a bit of a chocolate smuggler, I guess you'd call it. But he's always got some nice German chocolate. But he met some other folks, too.
Hey, Airplane Geeks. We're here at the show, and I've been called out by one of our new listeners.
Hi there. I'm Julian Tucker.
From?
From West Palm Beach.
And he called us out, and now he's a big airplane geek, too, here at Sun and Fun. But who's not a big airplane geek at Sun and Fun?
All right. So I mentioned I did a number of episodes. I did a number of interviews for Sun and Fun Radio, which, by the way, you can listen to Sun and Fun Radio 24/7, 365, courtesy of liveatc.net. If you go to live, and you probably are aware of liveatc.net, but if you go there, liveatc.net/SNF, there's kind of an endless loop of interviews and other programs, both the roving interviews, for example, that I did, as well as some others, and also the interviews, the more formal interviews, I guess you'd say, on the deck of Sun and Fun Radio. So you can check those out there. So let me just put a cap on Sun and Fun. And what I would say is my observation of the crowd was that, rightly or wrongly, and without any judgment, people are just tired of being cooped up. And however people are justifying, you know, to themselves that it's not a risk, they're doing that because people just want to get out and socialize and return to some semblance of normalcy. But
normalcy.
Something like that. You get the idea, right? That's my impression. I think people just kind of have had enough, at least the tens of thousands of people that were in Lakeland, Florida for that week. So, yeah, we'll see. Of course, the big question is, all right, so what about Oshkosh and what's going to happen there? I'm still making plans to be there. It sounds like plans are still being made. But I think, don't we know that May is kind of the decision date for the organizers?
Yeah, we do. The last we heard, because I talked to some of the guys at EA Radio a couple of weeks ago, and they're kind of planning on, by May 15th, we're going to hear a definite yay or nay. I would be very surprised if it was nay. I think, you know, we've been talking about AirVenture happening since last year, but with restrictions. I don't know exactly what those will be, but if it turned out to be what you're saying it was at Sun and Fun, I can only imagine what it's going to be like in Oshkosh. Yeah. You know, and they have pretty good beer up there on top.
Yeah.
Oh, and Bratz.
Bratz?
Or is that Bratz? Bratz.
Yeah. No,
Bratz are what
kids.
You bring, yeah. And Bratz are what you give
you
the
feed
kids.
Them.
You the Bratz, right? Okay.
Yeah. One more thing I just wanted to mention is that the Blue Angels, of course, in there. This was the first performance of their new planes.
Was it good?
Yes, it was good. It was loud.
They broke a jet where one of the pilots got sick.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Well, they only flew five all weekend. They didn't fly six.
Hmm.
One of the pilots was grounded. They flew five ship.
Yeah, that's what I saw.
They didn't fly the six ship. So one of the pilots was out for either health or they broke a jet, which, God forbid, they just got them. They shouldn't be breaking ease.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But they're under warranty.
Yeah, covered.
If there is such a thing.
Yeah, kind of there is. Yeah, and the crowd, the crowd really enjoyed the performance. You could see that there were a lot of people that had, this was on Saturday, I'll say, because they perform, I think, three times during the course of the week. But the big crowd is on the weekends, and Saturday was the bigger day. And there were a lot of attendees who I would say, had not seen a show, a performance like the Blue Angels before. And there were both adults and kids with just wide open mouths, jaws dropping, were just squealing with delight over the performance. There were some other great performances, some aerobatic performances that were really, really impressive. There were some nice glider. The Night Air Show was really impressive. There was a drone show, a nighttime drone show, even. And Dave and I will probably talk about that in this week's UAV Digest. So the performances were really, really top-notch, really impressive. And I know I keep saying one more thing. The drone light show was pretty impressive. That was followed by a fireworks display. And one thing that David and I comment on UAV Digest with these drone shows is that maybe these will end up replacing fireworks shows in the future. Well, I don't know if Sun and Fun saved up all the fireworks they didn't shoot off from last year and add them to the fireworks they were going to buy anyway for this year. But the fireworks display was incredibly impressive for me because I saw lots of kinds of fireworks I'd never seen before. I mean, there's the usual stuff, you know, I mean, there's this kind, there's that kind. But I saw some other kinds of aerial pyrotechnics that were very different. But anyway, my point being that after seeing that, I don't think that fireworks are going to be threatened by drone light shows anytime in the near future.
They're not. They're much more coordinated. I mean, because you can link all the drones together, but they're not as spectacular.
Yes,
I think when they go off,
and the formation moves more slowly than you might think. I've noticed in a couple of YouTube videos of these, you know, these massive drone light shows, that the video has been speeded up. And now I know why, because they move a little kind of slower than, you know, you'd sort of like, which is kind of.
Well, how close are they to each other?
Well, I don't know. The reason I don't know is because it's dark.
It's dark.
And there are lights in the sky, you know, and I can't tell how
far away, too.
And yeah, they're not real, real close.
The part I always enjoy about the drone shows is the invariable ones that drop out. It looks like, you know, wax falling off a candle. You know, you just see, it's like invariably there's always a few of them that drop out.
Yeah, yeah. So look for UAV Digest. I actually interviewed the company that did that, and hopefully I'll have that ready for that episode this week. All right, David, talk to me about Lego.
Well, being an adult fan of Lego or an AFOL.
Wait a minute, an AFOL.
Adult fan of Lego.
Oh, jeez. All right. You're not called like Legotistas or?
No.
Lego maniacs or?
No.
Okay.
So Lego has a process where you can submit a design to them, and then they run a survey, and if it reaches a certain limit, they will go ahead and consider it and put it in production. Quite a few sets have done this. Well, on Twitter today, I saw something I think most av geeks would want. I mean, now I got really excited because they decided for my birthday to release a brand new R2-D2, which that's another story. But this thing, and you can go vote for it, is a 747 cockpit, a cutaway cockpit. And it gives you linked yokes, 4 independent throttle controls, as well as flaps and spoiler levers. They'll all work. Instrument panels, including main display, center console, and overhead consoles, sliding seats and moving armrests, external fuselage matching the aircraft contour. This is all pilot minifigure scale, so, and 1,874 parts.
And a rubber band.
And a rubber band. Yeah. And hopefully printed Legos instead of decals, but
It's a really, really well-designed set. And I could see a lot of people, especially AvGeeks, if you're not really a diehard Lego fan, you might want this because, you know, it plays with you can play with the yokes and stuff and do your flight simulating. And we'll have to find out. We'll have to talk to some of our friends who we know that are 747 pilots in various airlines like Miami Rick to find out what they think of the accuracy. But it looks pretty good to me.
It does.
How big is it?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's hard to tell. They don't say it specifically.
Yeah, I was going to say it is. I can't quite tell myself, but
it's got to be kind of
pretty cool.
Good size. I mean, 1,800 parts.
If it's going to have movable yokes and stuff, yeah. I mean, it will be a decent sized cockpit.
Not something you could sit in, obviously.
No, obviously not. But you know, it'll be a really good scale model of the cockpit.
So I see here that it says the number of supporters, the number of days left. Do people go out and vote? And you know, how many votes are required?
I don't. It should give you a list on the vote on the webpage vote of what the requirement is.
I have seen these kinds of things, you know, from Lego before in the past, where somebody says, "Well, why don't they make a this or that?" And then the design sort of gets created, and people. Like David said, people vote on it, and Lego must have some data that tells them that, well, if 1,000 people vote for it, that means, 100 will actually purchase the kit, and is 100 enough to justify the production? I mean, they probably calculate all that stuff too.
Yeah. And not necessarily everything gets made. I mean, there are a lot of these things that, one of the examples for this set was a very famous set was if you saw this Friends television show, they made somebody submitted a Friends cafe with all the minifigures being the cafe that they all hung out with. That one was one of the another ones that became one was Ecto-1, which was the Ghostbusters ambulance. That became a set that was done originally by someone who prototyped it. So, but there's a lot of AvGeeks out there who are Lego fans. So if you want your scale 747 cockpit, the Queen of the Skies Lego set is calling your name.
Well, so they say the next milestone is 5,000 supporters. They currently have 4,293, only 707 more to go. We have a lot more listeners than that, so I'm thinking we ought to include a link in the show notes and push this thing forward.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at this earlier one, an Air Force One version with a full interior. It was 6 feet long. I mean, that's a pretty darn good size model.
Yeah, where do you put that? Yeah. All right. Max Trescott, what's new with you?
Well, I have been flying like crazy the last 4 weeks. I'm back in the skies, but I'm also keeping Aviation News Talk cranking along. And I just wanted to mention that a week ago we had what I thought was one of the best episodes, episode 184. I had a Boeing experimental test pilot on. He, by the way, flies F-18s as they come off the production line, essentially, to make sure that they're going well. But he had an engine failure in a beach bonanza when he was flying in Florida, and he was IFR above multiple cloud layers at the time. And he basically did what I thought was flawless execution of managing an engine out failure. I've interviewed folks before who've had engine failures, but this was quite different. This was a guy who was the right place in the right time and who was kind of on the edge of being able to make it work, and he did. And so he really kind of explains all the kind of the critical elements, both of his normal plan, which is always knowing instantly what heading to turn to in case he has any kind of trouble, how rapidly he executed that, what kind of bank angle he used so he could do that quickly. We talked about how best glide varies with weight. He was not going to make it at the normal best glide speed, but knowing that he was lighter than max gross weight, he was able to pick a lower speed, did make it. So just fascinating. Of course, he also lost various instruments because the engine, you know, stopped running. It was descending through layers of clouds, got great vectors from a Jacksonville approach. So really fascinating story.
And that's the latest episode.
Yeah, episode 184. So it came out about a week ago. Episode 185 is actually up now as of yesterday.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought. Well, you know, you're getting close to a big milestone there with 200 coming up.
Yep, and that's when I'm going to quit. Just kidding.
Yeah, that's what Max said.
Yeah. Did Max say something like that, David?
Yeah, I several times I've heard him say things like that.
I said I was going to stop at 500, but here we are.
Yeah, that's when you got rid of me. Don't you remember that?
Yeah, clearly.
That was a... Yes. and then you stayed anyway. See, that wasn't fair. That wasn't supposed to be part of the deal.
Oh.
But I fell for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, okay, we're all going to get out of the car at the same time, except the rest of us, Rob.
So, Max, are you going to do something big and special for 200? Maybe you could invite all of us on.
There you go. That sounds like fun.
Yeah. I wouldn't
do that. Except what would be newsy about that?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We could bring out the clown car, and we'd have all four clowns here.
That's right.
There you go.
Speaking of clowns, Rob, so are you making any aviation lately?
Am I making any aviation?
Yeah, you know, it's like making art, well, you know, or like your daughter makes comedy.
Not as much. I mean, I'm making up things about aviation. I mean, anything, that's what writers do, you know.
Anything
of course.
Good?
Oh, yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard to tell, but no, actually, we're just starting now to talk about, is Oshkosh really happening? How are we going to deal with it? What's our procedure going to be? But also between now and AirVenture, I have a couple of flights to complete down in beautiful Wichita. I think I said this last time. If I did, then you can just simply cut it out. But I have to go down and do a test flight on a King Air 360 and also a brand new Bonanza G36 that will put one of the old ones to shame. And I believe the Bonanza is more expensive than the SR-22, isn't it, Max?
Boy, I would have thought that they were somewhere in the same ballpark. I mean, the difference is that's a six-seat aircraft, and it's retractable. So, yeah, it might be more expensive. But I always think of them both as being in the same general ballpark.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a really nice airplane. And so they invited me, and I said, well, I don't know. When do you want me there? But it'll also be the first time I'll be on an airliner. So it's going to be a little strange.
Yeah. All of the airline pilots I ran into at Sun and Fun were talking about how busy they were and how, you know, yields were so high and people are returning.
And cargo is still up.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Anything else, Robert?
No, not really. Right. Trying to train Archie, you know, it's quite a handful. Okay. Yes,
all right.
My dog. He's gotten a little big, as we would say in the old days. He's gotten a little big for his britches, except he doesn't wear any. I hope I'm not offending anybody when I mention that, but so he has a little work to do. Obviously, not like David's guy. So.
All right.
Yeah, well, my pup is a little more scaled towards my lap than Archie is to yours.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right. I think Launchpad's still kicking around here somewhere.
Hey, Airplane Geeks listeners. Max told me if I waited here, I could find Rob. So I'm going to wait out here on the Warbird line. Still waiting. Still waiting for Rob. He's got to show up sooner or later out here on the Warbird line.
That was pretty cruel of you to send him out there and make him wait for Rob.
All right.
I'm sorry. That's really pretty funny. It doesn't quite top the the time when David and I first met, though, when he said, oh, you see that airplane over there landing? That's an A380. And, okay, you had to be there, yeah. But it was, you know. But launch pads, you know,
I've never forgotten the embarrassment as those words came out of my mouth. Now, folks, if you don't know the story, literally I had just picked him up at the airport and I had met him in person for maybe 10 minutes at most. And we're at Dulles and an A380 British Airways coming, starts landing. And it was the first one I had ever seen. And I said, wow, an A380, have you ever seen one? Now, as I was saying it, my brain then remembered that about 3 weeks before this, Rob had been in France at the Airbus factory piloting an A380, and I felt like a complete and utter idiot.
Well, I wouldn't feel too bad, though, David, really. I mean, I have gotten so many of those up on you where I feel much dumber. So you got a long way to go to catch up.
Good story.
Yeah, it was.
All right, on to some listener mail. Patrick Wiggins wrote to us. He said, after a nearly 15-month pandemic-induced delay, I finally resumed my position of the Women of Aviation Worldwide Flight Program. This is super cool. First up was 9-year-old Sunny. He says the name matches her disposition. She was flying left seat in a photo that he supplied. It was her first ever flight in a small airplane, and she got to celebrate by doing some of the flying. And Patrick says, and just like any true pilot, she said she's going to tell all her friends what she did. Sunny apparently is the 252nd Women of Aviation Worldwide participant that Patrick has flown, which is really amazing and very impressive and a really good thing. He does mention, he says, next on Sonny's very young bucket list is a tandem skydive next week in Colorado. So this definitely sounds like a budding aviator. He did send us a picture of Sonny. I'd love to put it in the show notes, but I don't know if, because since Sonny is an underage child, if we really have permission to do that. Or if this is just shared with us. So I probably won't put it in the show notes, but just imagine a 9-year-old girl sitting in the left seat, hand on the yoke, with a big, big smile on her face, peering around the microphone from her headset.
Big, toothy grin.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool thing to do.
Cute kid. Yep. Looks like they're in an older Cessna, maybe a 172. I see the old light switch up on the side post there.
Ah, very observant.
And it's been reupholstered, so nice seats there.
Now, Patrick also sent an article on electric flight. This is by eFlyer 800. Will fly you and seven of your closest friends 500 nautical miles at 320 knots. Or more with solar. It's from electric.co. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And then one final item. This was from Tom, who wrote in and provided a link. Air Force unveils new mission statement. Now, the Air Force has released this new mission statement, which is this. It's to fly, fight, and win. Air power anytime, anywhere. And the Air Force says this change emphasizes the primary competitive advantage and capabilities air power provides to the nation in joint operations. So my question was to David, who, of course, immediately had the answer, was, what was the old mission statement? And David, have you got it there? Have you got it in front of you?
It's to fly, to fight, and win in the air, space, and cyberspace. Now, if you listen to that, you can understand why the mission statement changed, because they're not responsible for space and cyberspace anymore. They are only responsible because we now have Space Command. excuse me, Space Force, not Space Command. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of a video game and not a military organization. It's a mission statement. Anybody who's been in sort of any sort of modern day organization, mission statements are a dime a dozen. If you really want to listen to an amazing song, listen to Weird Al Yankovic's song "Mission Statement," which is literally every mission statement you have ever heard, and every political jargon that you could possibly imagine. It is downright hysterical. So the Air Force has changed its mission statement. It's dropped to cyberspace and space. So congratulations, Air Force. Go fight, win, and off we go into the wild blue yonder.
All right. Rob, do you have a mission statement at Flying Magazine?
Okay.
Boy, I wish I could hear Max. It seems like my earphones have gone somewhat dead. People are probably wondering, God knows what he's probably asking me, but of course I can't hear him, so I couldn't be expected to possibly come up with an answer. But maybe some other day I will be able to answer the question I don't know that Max is asking me. I think I'll just shut up now.
Okay. He's too busy writing articles. I mean, that's stuff for upper management to worry about.
Yes. There you go.
No, actually, I don't know what our mission statement is. I probably should. I'll probably get yelled at for not knowing that, but I don't really know what it is.
That's right. Keep writing, Rob. Keep writing.
Keep writing.
Okay. All right. Write faster. Write faster.
Faster, more faster. All right. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll wrap this up. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. You can send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, well, you can visit airplanegeeks.com, or you can go to airplanegeeks.com/651, because that's the episode number.
Will Launchpad be in this one? If we're, because we don't know where he is right now, right?
Yeah, where is he?
Launchpad.
If I were Rob Mark, where would I be? I'd be in the hangars looking at new products. Let's go there. Rob.
Oh, man. All right. He did a good one.
He did. We're just all sitting here laughing. Yeah. that was really creative and hilarious. We'll have to thank him.
It was. I don't think I could have fit under the deck, though. Could I? I think it's kind of close.
It is. It's a tight squeeze.
Yeah.
But see, people are talking about you even when you're not there, Rob. That's the sign of a celebrity.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I don't need as much talking about as I used to. Anyway, we'll talk about that some other time. When we all see each other in Osh. Let's see, David, you think you'll go to Oshkosh, or will you not be able to get away?
I probably am not going to Oshkosh this year. Okay. I have to plan our 25th anniversary celebration for the museum, and so I most of the summer as well as all of October, I'm going to be pretty busy.
Wow, you're the only person I've ever met who's married to a museum. I mean, that's incredible. The two of you have stuck together for 25 years now. That's great.
Absolutely.
Are you?
And I couldn't be happier.
Are you, David? Are you going to have a specific event, like a big event or something?
We are going to have a banquet. We are going to be unveiling our R6 helicopter, which is almost complete, as well as giving an award to NASA for the Ingenuity product. So our month of October will be a very busy month. We have events and we'll be debuting a Tuskegee Airmen exhibit.
So for those of you, this is the American Helicopter Museum.
Yes, it is.
In October, huh? Let's check calendar. So is this banquet going to be open to anybody who buys a ticket?
Maybe. I might be able to get, as a general rule, the banquet's kind of hard because right now we don't know how many people we're allowed to have.
Yeah.
So let's just say right now, the banquet's going to be held. We'll have to provide you more information later.
Okay. Well, keep us informed on the dates so we can crash the party.
Okay. I will. Yes, I'm sure that you will bring you and your lovely lady to the picnic, the party.
Yeah. I have a busy October, I think. But okay.
Wait a minute. Just one thing. I thought Max was going to bring the other Max and me to the party. No?
You don't fit in the trailer.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. You have a cool trailer. Does it have an Airplane Geeks flag on it or something? Will people be able to find it at AirVenture?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yes. This is good. All right, guys. Hey, thank you for inviting me again. And
all right,
nighty night.
Well, wait a minute. Now you got to tell us where they. You got to tell everybody where they can find you online.
Same place they always do.
Okay, Max Trescott. How about you?
Same place they always do.
See, we've just compressed the entire show. I mean, no, they find me at Flying Magazine or at Jetwine.com or. God knows which of the social media platforms I'm even on, but I'm in there somewhere.
Okay. And Max Trescott.
The usual place, head on out to aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top, or you can also find the podcast wherever you get podcasts.
And David Vandroff.
You could find me on the Slack team, and you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, you can find me on social media everywhere and the American Helicopter Museum, as well as the UAV Digest with Max Flight.
Very good. And look for me at the website 30,000feet.com. And with that, I'll say please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Hey, good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.